Hello, you're listening to The Sower, a podcast of the Ciceronian Society. The Ciceronian Society exists to equip and encourage Christian scholars to serve the church as a center of cultural and civic renewal. Through our events, publications, and podcasts, we provide the space and opportunities needed by academic leaders among Protestant, Catholic, and Orthodox communities for professional growth and intellectual discipleship. Since 2012, we have been building a network of friends with a love for our core themes, tradition, place, and things divine, and with a genuine commitment to the church and the life of the mind. To learn more about us, our events, this podcast, our journal, Pietas, to sign up for our newsletter and make your tax-deductible gift, please go to ciceroniansociety.org. I'm Josh Bowman, Executive Director of the Ciceronian Society, and before we get started, please join me in a brief prayer. In the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit, we pray, O Lord, that you would bless our conversation and that all we say and do would bring glory and honor to you. Amen. I am grateful to be joined today by two friends, Josh Herring and Winston Brady. Welcome to the show, guys.
Thanks, Josh. Great to be here.
Yeah, thanks, Josh. Appreciate the invitation.
All right, so we'll start with two quick introductions. Dr. Josh Herring is a professor of classical education and humanities at Thales College. He's the host of the Optimistic Curmudgeon podcast. That's a great name. And author of a book called Sons of Adam, Daughters of Eve, C.S. Lewis's Images of Gender, published with Davenant Press. He also directs the Certificate in Classical Education Philosophy, which we'll talk about later, and loves working with teachers to deepen their immersion in the classical tradition. And Winston Brady is Director of Curriculum at Thales Academy and Director of Thales Press. And he has taught at Thales Academy since 2011. He has taught history, trivium, and literature at almost every grade level from 6th grade through 12th grade, as well as the occasional Latin class. He also hosts the Thales Academy podcast, Developing Classical Thinkers. So let's start here, guys. Who was Thales? I keep saying Thales. Is it Thales or Thales?
Thales.
Thales with the
Thales of Miletus.
Thales of Miletus. All right. So, who is he or who was he? Why'd you name this whole operation after him?
Thales of Miletus was a pre-Socratic philosopher. He's contemporaneous with Croesus, if you know the phrase rich as Croesus. So, he was a king of Lydia around 589 BC. And it's Cyrus the Great that conquered Croesus of Lydia. But Thales of Miletus was an astronomer and an engineer, an early progenitor of free market economics. There's some great apocryphal stories about Thales of Miletus. He predicted that there would be a huge bumper harvest of olives. And so he bought out all the olive oil pressing equipment and then he rented it out once the bumper crop came in. There's a story of him staring up at the heavens so intently that he fell into a well. And Herodotus has a story of him building a canal for Croesus while they're engaged in some warfare, not with Cyrus the Great and the Persians, but the Medes. He's also he predicts an eclipse that is so unbelievably accurate that, today we can go back and we can date other events in around that eclipse there. But he predicted such an eclipse was going to happen. He told the Lydians that. The Medes, however, when the eclipse took place, were so scared that they immediately sued for peace. The gods must be angry with them. We have to stop right now. But the important thing about Thales of Miletus is that he's the, quote, first scientist. So the first individual to ascribe natural phenomenon to natural causes and not the gods. It's not that the gods are angry with us, but there's a series of laws and rules that are taking place here that are intelligible and discernible to the human mind.
So I'll just add a couple of details to that. I mean, in terms of the history of philosophy, Thales of Miletus sits as one of the pre-Socratic philosophers. There's this big break with Socrates, and Thales of Miletus is one of the folks before Socrates who's trying to come up with a natural explanation of the world. As Winston mentioned, that's one of the things that makes him very notable. Now, I always like telling my students that we don't remember him because he got the right answer. Mm-hmm. We remember him because he had a different kind of answer. Thales of Miletus believed that everything was made of water. It's table, mm-hmm. really hard water. Winston, also water. The screens we're using to record, slightly less hard water. Thales' answer was wrong, but he was the first one to say, okay, well, everything can be explained by material causes. And to your question, Josh, about why we're named after him, There's probably two parts to that answer. That first, certainly there's a lot to commend in Thales of Miletus. There's also the issue of unclaimed real estate space in the classical education movement. Thales
Yeah.
Academy was started in 2007, and by that time there were already a lot of other named academies. As far as we're aware, there were no other Thales Academies, so it made a great there was a great opportunity for us to say, okay, we both like this guy, and we're going to copyright that name.
Yeah.
And our founder, oh, go ahead.
No,
I mean,
was
I was just going to add.
It was really relatable, but the real estate for the name for Cicero, it was so surprising that there weren't other Ciceronian societies when we started. But we also couldn't take Augustinian, which is always the joke that was the better name, but because that's in many ways who we are. But again, I it's certainly relatable. Cicero thought differently in many ways, or thought more. Proficiently, or what's the word? Effectively, or with greater precision than many of his contemporaries, and I think there's a lot to recommend there. So, you were going to add something, Winston?
Oh yeah, our founder Bob Luddy, his daughter suggested the name. You know, hey, this is an individual that's really got like a unique process when it comes to coming up with the right answer, figuring out what is true, something that's more akin to the scientific method. Mm-hmm. Our founder, Robert Luddy, he owns a kitchen equipment ventilation company called Captive Air. And he himself, Bob, really kind of integrates that very like practical scientific mindset. Like, hey, we're going to get things to work, and we're going to figure out processes that make things more effective and more efficient and deliver more value. But he also really is intent on the classics, like an appreciation of philosophy and history and literature. So Thales really brings together those like two ideas in the same person. You know, he didn't just dig a canal for Croesus, but he also loved the heavens so much and so intent upon gazing on them that he wasn't necessarily looking at what was under his feet falling into a well. The other story too, the kind of apocryphal, but that he predicted like a bumper crop of like olives, and he rented out olive harvesting equipment. Like, that's a great illustration of the laws of supply and demand. And Bob, too, is a very strong proponent of free market economics. And so there's just one more reason why Thales just like uniquely fits everything he's trying to build in a private classical school.
So speaking of Bob, how did all this get started? You started to answer that a little bit. Clearly, Bob was a big part of this. But what? How did you all start down this road?
Well, back in 2007, a group of parents approached Bob and asked for his help in founding a new kind of private school. Bob had previously run for the school board in the state of North Carolina. And while that campaign wasn't successful, he got his name out there as somebody who was really intent on changing the status quo in education and to try to make schools serve the needs of students rather than, say, teachers' unions or like a large bureaucratic administrative apparatus or whatever. So these parents approached Bob and asked for his help, and Bob had A, spare office space in his corporate headquarters at Captive Air, and B, just the time and willingness to pour into a new school and helping it get off the ground. So he opened up like just a bunch of spare office spaces at Captive Air. We're actually recording at his corporate headquarters here in Raleigh, North Carolina. But he opened up like a handful of office spaces, and that was the first like kindergarten, first and second grade class. Really amazing. I joke that he's kind of like John D. Rockefeller. You know, John D. Rockefeller was like a billionaire industrialist, you know, owner of Standard Oil and so forth, and founder of the University of Chicago. But John D. Rockefeller really disliked going to the campus of the University of Chicago. Do you know why?
I don't know why.
They would ask him for money. And, you know, hit him up for like some new project or initiative, like, hey, we've got this idea for a new building here on campus. Can you make this happen for us, Mr. Rockefeller? Well, like, our founder, Bob, is not only providing like, you know, his largesse in terms of money and financial support, but he's also providing like tons of time, you know, coming to school events, coming to graduations, speaking to groups of students concerning like what they should be doing while they're in school and out of school. It's just really amazing just the energy that this man has and the passion that he has to try to create better educational outcomes for students.
So that first group in the back offices of Captive Air is a little bit legendary within our schools. I ended up teaching a couple of those guys all the way through in high school, and they've since gone on to careers and grad school programs now. But Bob really, another part of his business acumen is really hitting a niche in the market before it becomes particularly evident. So even in 2005, 2006, there was clearly a demand for a higher quality education than the local public school offerings here in Wake County. And so by the time we hit 2010, 2011, there's already two Thales Academy campuses that are starting high school programs. And by the time you get to 2019, I think we were up to, I don't know, 12 campuses or so before COVID. And today we're at now 17 distinct campuses and somewhere between 6,000 and 7,000 students. What we're providing to parents really kind of hit this niche of a high quality, affordable cost classical education.
That provides a good segue here because the next question is not controversial at all. But there's a lot of energy and
Let's
excitement.
go.
And I know, here we go, man. Lots of energy and excitement in classical ed in recent years. But a comic amount of wrestling about what that actually is, what it means, right? What is classical education? What makes an education classical? Is it the togas? Is it, you only listen to classical music while you read? And I know a definitive answer that everyone agrees on. I mean, in my view, I don't think it's even feasible. But as a school, I assume you have some kind of working understanding or definition about what you mean when you say classical education. So what's the definition that y'all are working with?
Well, grounded in the great books of the Western tradition. So it's part of like an intellectual inheritance that we hope to pass on to students and oriented towards the transcendentals of truth, beauty, and goodness so that there are ideas that are true, independent of the human mind, that they give meaning to value to life and that we can concentrate on those ideas and they help to form and shape the character of the students. I think like at least one tagline that I like playing around with is that the goal of classical education is that students would know what is good, you know, so they've encountered things that are good in their history class, in the literature class. They've read through authors that have wrestled with this question as to what is the good life? Like, what am I here for? What is my purpose? Is there a God? And if so, does he love me? And the second half of that is that students would be able to persuade others to choose what is good too. I feel like there's got to be that outward-facing focus of classical education. There's that strong emphasis on community and engagement and friendship. And for the students that are going through a classical school, you know, they've not only got to be able to know what is good, but they have to have those rhetorical skills to be able to persuade others to, you know, not go down the paths of folly and ruin, but to stick to the paths of wisdom and virtue, making the sorts of choices that are going to lead towards a happy and flourishing sort of life. So, and I can draw to like, I mean, I honestly, I went to a classical, like a prep school in the DC area that had a classical curriculum, but it wasn't always oriented towards those transcendental ideas of, you know, God existence and the implications for a person's life based on that. And I think what separates all of these classical schools that are in revival right now is that they are linked towards those transcendentals, those ideas that are true independent of the human experience.
I think that's right. I would probably add maybe two other things. Like classical education begins with a certain understanding of the human person. We recognize the human person as born into a family and growing within community and as a mixture of an individual person, but really having all these different identities layered on top of that person. And that, so part of what children are doing as they're going through education is they're unfolding their own potential. And they're growing into everything that they're made to be. And so the way that we do that becomes really important. If we take that, think that that's not really, and this is the part I think everyone in education agrees with. We all agree that education matters a lot. In classical education, we think it matters that we actually give students the best of what's been thought and taught, as Matthew Arnold put it, because that's what's going to help them truly grow into everything that is there potentially. The other piece I would say, it's relatively easy to talk about classical ed in terms of the arts of the trivium, anything related to writing or reading or languages. It's sometimes harder to think about, well, what does it mean to teach? What do you do if you're thinking about math and science and engineering, architecture? What are those things classically? I usually explain this to teachers not so much as a difference in content. If you're studying chemistry, you still are teaching the periodic table of elements, for example. But the classical approach to science is really not about learning the tools of mastery over reality so that we can twist it and we can make the world into our own image. Rather, it's all about deeply studying reality as it is and learning to appreciate that. And that takes us in both science and math into really the study of the people who have made these discoveries, to take them as models for how we then approach studying reality as a place of beauty and wonder. And that math is not just a bunch of cool intellectual tricks we can do, but math is actually literally learning the language of reality and learning to describe the real and be able to perceive it deeply. So I would argue that classical education has everything to do with studying reality and being able to know it and to articulate the real very deeply. And that this is really what education has always been about. Jeremy Tate at the Classical Learning Test loves saying that 150 years ago, classical education was just education. Mm-hmm. In a very real sense, we're just trying to kind of get back to that. We've had about 100 years of really failed philosophy of education that has led to failed outcomes. And we think there's a lot of things that students need to study, and there's certain attitudes with which teachers need to approach those subjects. And all together, we label that classical education.
Yeah. And the attitude, when you're talking about the beauty and awe and wonder with mathematics and science, it's just like the story Coleridge and the waterfall that C.S. Lewis uses to open mm-hmm. up the abolition of man. You know, the waterfall like is sublime, not that the waterfall gives right. me sublime feelings or something. It's acknowledging that, you know, the world and its operations and, you know, all this beauty and wonder that we can see in it, like that is far greater than anything that, you know, that I am. Contemporary science education, progressive education really starts with man at the center as the measure of all things and moving forward. I love the idea of science. I don't like the idea of science as mastery, but I like being able to understand that yeah. because that's really where everybody's heart is when it comes to scientific education, just education in general.
So I mean, there's a lot we could say about this. I think there's a level of humility, I think, to what you're talking about with classical education. We are heirs. You know, we're not trying to master any, you know, just like you just said, we're not trying to master anything or take over. It's also a level of, and this is where so much of modern education, I'm both the left and the right, is just getting this wrong. And I think especially what Winston said was moving toward this, that our education is not simply for, it's not just for me. When I learn something, I'm not simply learning so that I feel better about myself, so that I can look in the mirror and be like, man, I just nailed it today. I'm a genius. But it's also not only to persuade people about what is the good, because if you know what the good is, you're going to be served by that. You're going to be, it's a way of loving others, frankly, in the sense that you're educated, you learn in order to love and serve others. It is an outward focusing philosophy of education. Now, it doesn't mean that classical ed has the you know, cornered the market on this, but the idea that education is not simply you know, just navel gazing and simply for my own edification and professional development and acquisition, right? It's a much deeper sense of that. So I'm encouraged by the way you were describing that. And I wanted to come back then, you know, building on this then to each of your individual projects in particular. Because you think about content and method. So I want to go back to Winston in particular. Give me a sense of kind of how you're with designing curriculum, and then also related, of course, to Thales Press, how is that informing the exact way that you're going about this and the way you're doing it?
Well, it's Thales Press tries to make it easier for teachers to teach and students to study everything that is good, true, and beautiful. Thales Academy is unique amongst private schools, especially in the North Carolina area, in that we have 15 campuses, mostly in Raleigh, North Carolina. Like every small town outside of North Carolina typically has like a Thales campus. We have one in Holly Springs, one in Cary, one in Pittsburgh, one in Apex, one in Rollsville, one in Clayton, Knightdale, North Raleigh, and Wake Forest. And just given how many different campuses we have, as well as one outside of Charlotte, North Carolina, one outside of Nashville, Tennessee, and one outside of Richmond, Virginia, there's always a need to make it easier for teachers to implement lesson plans in the classroom, make it easier on them to execute and to form relationships with students, to grade papers, to plan their lessons, and so forth. And every year, I noticed that it was getting a little bit harder to ensure that high level of quality, as well as just like easing the burdens on the faculty members. So I think Josh was teaching like a variety of humanities classes too, at the high school level, we had some humanities classes collectively called Trivium, but there was one in particular, it was ninth grade research and writing, and we were asking teachers, you know, part of the trend in education today is to give standards and learning objectives to faculty members and then trust them to come up with like the best way of implementing those standards. But what that really ensures is kind of a Wild West mentality that we're all trying to make it to the West Coast, we're trying to make it to Oregon. You know, we're all just in our little Constantinople wagons and we're just trying to make it across the Great Plains. That doesn't really work at scale. You know, people's wagons get, you know, swept away by rivers. You know, you run out of food. There's just all sorts of problems that come in with that. So I wanted to make it as easy as possible for new teachers coming in that they wouldn't have to do the huge heavy lifting of lesson planning. So with this first book, Ninth Grade Research and Writing, I recruited a couple of really good teachers within our network since the class encompassed grammar, writing lessons, and then meaningful primary sources. I recruited our best grammar teacher, Elizabeth Jaton. She's still with us at Thales today, making really good writing manuals and grammar books for us. I recruited Josh Herring. So Josh wrote a handful of the writing lessons for this particular book. And then I wrote a handful of other writing lessons, and I did a lot of the primary sources trying to integrate them all. But the goal was that, you know, for the new teacher coming in, if they got this class, they could, you know, their pacing guide pretty much was this textbook. And if nothing else, they could turn the page for the next day and there were their lesson plans. So every chapter had three lessons to it. One was a grammar lesson, one was a writing lesson, and then one was a primary source that meaningfully integrated either the grammar lesson or the writing lesson. So if they're writing compare and contrast essays, I had a short excerpt from Machiavelli in The Prince where he compares and contrasts how princes should imitate a lion or a fox, depending on the circumstances there. When the grammar lesson was on verbals and infinitives, you know, infinitives like to strive, to seek, to find, not to yield. Well, I made sure to get Alfred Lord Tennyson's Ulysses. The chapter was on poetry, and I made sure to point out that particular usage of infinitives there, the way that he ends the poem, talking about to strive, to seek, to find, and not to yield. Just this beautiful and brilliant use of infinitives there. But just trying to make like what are otherwise abstract grammar lessons or abstract writing lessons profoundly more real by tying them into the heritage of the Western tradition. So that's probably my favorite book that we put out there because it just serves such a radical practical need, making it easier on teachers who come into our campus so that our students could pick up the absolutely brilliant and beautiful treasures of the Western tradition that they've inherited.
Can I add to that real quick? The first year I taught, just to put some particulars to Winston's story, the first year I was hired at Thales, I had five unique preps. I had not taught any of those before. My favorite class to teach was seventh grade medieval history. I was provided a course description that told me I needed to cover everything that happened from the fall of the Roman Empire up through the fall of the Soviet Union. And I had a year and I had a nice, sweet little homeschool textbook that was written for a smart 6 year old. That was it. And so it was my favorite class in part because I learned the most to teach that class. I had not studied anything really in the first 1,000 years or so. I focused on early modern history in college, but I spent most of the year going home after the workday was over, spending an hour to 2 hours reading to prep my lesson for the next day. It was phenomenal. I came out of that year, I had learned a ton about medieval and Renaissance history and 19th century stuff that I'd never studied before. Over the next like 3 or 4 years, I met so many new teachers at my school who had no interest in doing that kind of thing. It worked. That setting worked for me because I just have an internal compulsion to go home and read more about the stuff I want to know about.
Dare I say, you like learning.
That's true. But the possibly sad reality, but this is the real world. We have to deal with the reality, is that most teachers, especially if we're talking about a school network worth of teachers, most teachers want to go home and cook dinner and spend time with their family and hang out with their spouses and be involved at church. They don't really sign up for a career that's like, okay, please spend 8 hours teaching, spend 2 hours grading, and at least an hour and a half of learning new material for tomorrow.
Right.
It's so what Winston's building with this curriculum really does hit a very felt need, I think, amongst faculty.
And we just keep moving from one difficult class to another to try to create a textbook, test banks, PowerPoints, something of a closed ecosystem for a classical education school.
Mm-hmm.
So I love my job. It's a huge blessing to be able to make these sorts of resources. I do very much like learning. I joke that I would teach for free. You just have to pay me my salary plus benefits if I'm going to grade anything.
You're right.
grade, learning, like that's all fine. But
true.
If you want me to grade anything, you know.
Yeah.
Got to be
so,
checked.
So Thaddeus Academy is, that's K through 12, right?
Yeah, pre-K through 12th grade. And
pre-K.
Then because the school is very much like an outgrowth of Bob's, philanthropic vision to really create like a better school for kids that would otherwise go to the local public school. We're not competing with the local like elitist private schools in the Raleigh area. Sometimes we'll get kids coming from those schools or going to those schools, but really Thales is an alternative for the students that would otherwise go to the local public schools. If those schools are not serving their needs in some way, shape, or form, we don't really have to go down that road to talk about what those needs, those needs are, but the students that end up coming from the local public schools, the Thales, are generally the ones that are most excited and like on fire about learning and about the opportunities that Thales is offered, because that's just not what they were getting at the local high school. Like the grass really wasn't greener on the other side there. When they come to Thales and they get to read like, works by John Locke and Boethius, Plato in a variety of grade levels, Shakespeare in a variety of grade levels. Like for them, that's just like a breath of fresh air, mm-hmm. something that they weren't really exposed to in the last school that they went to.
Yeah. And then, so moving on then to what Josh is doing, then Thales College, as I understand it, is younger and kind of building on what Winston's talking about with these curriculum development and what we're already doing in the academy. What distinguishes then Thales College? And tell me a little more about that certificate you're developing.
Sure. So Thales College, as you're absolutely right, Josh, it's pretty new. We actually just graduated our first crop of students. We have eight alumni now. So we were founded in 2019. We did some soft launch pieces for a while, and then we had full college students join us in 2022. We currently offer just one degree. It's a Bachelor of Arts in Entrepreneurial Business and Liberal Arts. We're trying to take a kind of a different tact, where Thales Academy was started with the goal of being a scalable classical school model. Thales College is really looking at recovering some pieces that higher education has really forgotten. Mm-hmm. I usually explain this in terms of most universities today have forgotten what students ought to study, and they charge way too much mm-hmm. for the privilege of having students come study really worthless things.
Yeah.
And we want to attack both of those fronts. So we have our liberal arts major take students through a great sequence of literature, history, philosophy, ethics, economics, physics, calculus. We want them to be these well-rounded people who know a lot about a lot of different things. We also want them to be well prepared to step into whatever the future holds. This has become even more timely with all the focus this last year with AI, just because there are so many career fields that seem like they are just being obliterated on a month by month basis. We can't predict what jobs our students are going to go into, so we need them to be prepared with a really broad general foundation. And that's where the business major comes in. We want our students to be well prepared to either run their own business or be great employees in whatever field that they're doing. My provost loves talking about our project as helping students become prepared to become adults. Mm-hmm. We're not the place to come to if you're looking for a party school. We're not the place to come to if you want a fancy dorm with a lazy river or a rock climbing wall. There are other universities in North Carolina that have all of those things.
Yep.
That's not us. We are the place for kind of serious study and looking for great formation. So we're still in the very early phase. We do hope to grow as a college, but we're also wanting to grow well in the sense of preserving our identity, preserving our purposes, and really looking to cultivate a deep love of the Western tradition within our students. So that's part of what we're doing. On the certificate side that you ask about, that's something that we've developed to help meet one of the huge demand points in classical education. There are today somewhere between 6,000 and 10,000 classical schools nationwide. There's going to be a lot more, in part because the state of Texas just passed a massive school choice voucher program. So there's a lot more classical schools coming because the funding clearly exists to support them on a state level now. And so, but the problem is there are very few people who get this kind of formation that we're talking about in their undergraduate years. And there's, I won't go too deep into this, but the for the last 100 years, we have used education schools paired with textbook companies to sort of mass produce teachers on the assumption that teaching is a skill set and does not, and content is really irrelevant. That's false.
Yeah.
You can't really be a great teacher without actually knowing things. So part of the problem for all of these schools is that they can't actually hire enough classical teachers. There are somewhere between, I would say, 10 to 20 schools that are great hunting grounds for future classical schools. But as I'm sure anyone listening who has a background in business or any kind of recruitment knows, very few people are willing to move across the country for a job when they can get the same kind of job closer to home, closer to family. Mm-hmm. And so what we need to be able to do is help schools take the existing teachers they have and the teachers they can hire in their area and then work with them to become more classically minded. Mm-hmm. And that's where the certificate in classical education philosophy comes in. We believe that adults who are past that undergraduate time of formation, particularly those adults, learn best through the books that they read and the people that they meet. And so where this program is all built around a discussion-based pedagogy. Every class starts with a content lecture from a great instructor, and then people read a book. 2 weeks later, they come back for a 90-minute seminar on that book. Each class meets for a total of 5 times across 10 weeks, and it takes 8 classes to complete the certificate program. By the time they finish, teachers are well-versed in the ideas of human nature, in classical pedagogy, in the history of education, in the specific approaches that classical education seeks to have teachers take in humanities, in math, in science. They've looked at a little bit of how to prepare for stepping into leadership roles and what that would take. And then also at least able to dabble in some of the greatest texts in philosophy and ethics. And all of those go into helping form the classical teacher. So I'm very excited to tell you that as of last week, I now have 4 people who have completed the certificate, and we have about 70 folks who are still kind of working their way through. Wow. We're really excited to see where this goes.
That's really encouraging because, yeah, in a way we can't wait for a whole generation of classically educated kids to grow up and become the teachers. We need them now. That's going to be a huge challenge. I mean, one of the things I've thought about is, you know, to what extent are a lot of the like, college faculty, I used to be one, you know, our schools are closing because of enrollment issues and just funding issues and other things. And we're kind of ready to get out. It's not, I mean, one of the things I was always told, like, well, you can't get a job in academia. Why don't you just go teach high school or grade school? Well, it's a very different set of skills, as you guys know, in many ways. Although classical education, teaching that move from being a college professor to being a classical teacher in, say, the 7th grade classroom, to me seems a little less daunting, actually, because it's not as wrapped up in the bureaucracy of modern progressive education as it is. As I don't have to relearn all that lingo, right? In a sense, I can still be myself, but that also assumes that I'm a classically minded college professor as well, which, you know, as we know, is not normal. But have you seen some folks, and this is for both of you, transition? I don't want to say down, that doesn't make sense, but we're going to use that language down, you know, from college to the classical education world, because this need for teachers is very pronounced, and I hear it on many of these conversations, many conferences I go to where I talk to other classical schools. They're saying the same thing. How have you seen this play out? And is that certificate one of the answers to it?
So yes, I have seen that. We have seen that happen across several of our campuses. I'm not going to name names. I haven't asked any of these people if I can like name drop them about this, but I'm thinking of particular campuses. Sometimes it works. In most cases, it's worked really well. And we have people with degrees from, or terminal degrees from UNC Chapel Hill at a couple campuses. I've got a good friend who did a PhD in New Testament. He teaches Latin at one of our campuses. Mm-hmm. So we have several folks who, for all kinds of reasons, can't find jobs in the mainstream higher ed academy. And they then go down and look at, they look at classical schools. We also have it from kind of from the other end of the PhD market, where we have young folks who are have finished their degree and are looking. We have folks who are like coming out of higher ed and coming into the classical world. We mm-hmm. have other folks who are just finished with their dissertations. In both cases, I think the ideally these folks have studied some area that they have immense competency in. Mm-hmm. And so that their struggle is almost always going to be that first year where they have to learn the same things that every new teacher learns. Their disadvantage, though, is that they think they're already further along than they really are. And this is really a failing, I think, of our graduate training methods. Mm-hmm. Graduate training today does not teach classroom management. It nope. does not teach expectations of discipline and respect and authority. And the thing that any adult who steps into a middle school classroom must have from moment one is command of authority and insistence on respect, because there are 30 sixth graders and they are naturally wired to obey. But this is where I think our young teachers are disturbed by our moment. This came up at one of the last questions at the Academy of Philosophy and Letters last weekend. One previous grad student at Chapel Hill asked, well, what if my professor introduces himself as Bob and I want to go by Mrs. Austin is her name? Yeah. And the answer from the panel was, it really depends on your professor. Like, you've got to follow his lead and you can't insist on more formality than the professor does. In the K-12 world, everyone is Mr., Miss, or Mrs. last name, or Dr. Mm-hmm. last name. And that's just that there's still an insistence on that differentiation and respect. So I think part of, if you are an academic looking at that kind of transition, you definitely want to think about, just go in knowing you are going to learn a ton of things about how children learn. And children learn differently than young adults learn. It's just a totally different ballgame. Mm-hmm. The other thing I'll say about the certificate, and then see if Winston wants to chime in on this one, is that we have also seen I have a variety of people who are coming in with really looking to go into education as a second career, not mm-hmm. coming from academia downward, but coming from banking or IT or something kind of that nature, where the general vibe is, I have been in a career field where I've made my money, but it's this soulless, unsatisfying, meaningless job. Mm-hmm. And I can get by on a lower paycheck and I want to go into a meaningful career. And I think Winston and I would be in agreement that, like, teaching is by no means highly lucrative, but it is incredibly meaningful and wealthy in relationships.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, to be a good teacher, I think you need two things. The first is patience, and the second is content knowledge. And I would hold those as being equally valuable. The content knowledge is immensely valuable because, as the teacher, you are the source of authority that the students are to learn from. You can, you know, certainly, like, you know, ask for respect. You can enforce rules in your classroom. You're not giving that respect. But I think the best way to have respect of your students is to be profoundly intelligent in your chosen subject area, so mm-hmm. that you are a person that, like, those kids love to learn from. You know, in you're teaching medieval history, right? You not only know, like, the ins and outs of, like, every historical period, but you also know how people died. And whether or not they died happy, because that's the question yep. that the students are going to ask you. Did this person die? Of course they did. This was like 1066. Well, how did they die? Well, I'll tell you. And then you can go into
arrow in the eye.
Arrow in the eye. Yep.
Maybe the Bayeux Tapestry may have been changed by a group of nuns living in Bayeux, France. It's true. It may have happened. Like, there's an apocryphal story that perhaps, like, Harold Godwinson, like, wasn't randomly shot with an arrow. Maybe it was a hit squad from William the Conqueror. The story that I love telling from that is how William the Conqueror ends up dying, you know, decades later. He has a horseback riding accident. His stomach, like, explodes and his body starts filling up with gastric juices and so on. So, like, you can conquer England, But you basically swell up like the Pillsbury Doughboy, and that's how you go out. Did that person die happy? I don't think so.
Probably
But those
not.
are the sorts of questions that you need to be able to answer from students. Like, you have to be an expert in your field, and that takes a lot of time. With the patience aspect of it, you've got to be able to recognize that you're growing, like you're still very much a student. You are learning from from masters like Sophocles and Dante Alighieri and Virgil and Galileo and Isaac Newton. Like, you still haven't arrived when it comes to like how much there is to know. You're still learning very much alongside the students. That sort of patience, humility. I think Josh had mentioned humility a few times, but you've got to be willing to remember what it was like to be a middle school or a high school student and just some of the challenges that are going through there. You just got to remember, like, as a Christian, I think a lot about the patience that God has with me that I then try to bring out with the kids in my class. You can't tell them one time the right thing to do. You have to tell them literally a million times and then a few more times more. You've got to make it easy on the students to like take notes and pay attention. What does your classroom look like as far as removing distractions and making it easier on kids to fulfill those expectations that they need to if they're really going to learn and learn well? So with that, that's kind of a nebulous description of what the teacher should look like, patience and content knowledge. I think you can kind of go across the board what sort of background prepares students the best. I didn't go through a teaching program. I went to like a fairly traditional, contemporary, like progressive school. I went to William & Mary, and I didn't like a lot of the things that I got, like in some of the, it's a progressive school. It's not classical. There's not that orientation towards truth, beauty, and goodness. But maybe like some of the really good teachers that I had there, some of the, what was in the environment there just reminded me that there's something more to education, what you're trying to bring out with students in the classroom, trying to orient them towards ideas that are true, independent of the human experience. I can think about my own experience reading Dante. Like, that was my first real experience with like biblical Christianity, was like Dante's Inferno and like the footnotes to Dante's Inferno, because there's the Bible.
Saved by a footnote.
I know, right?
It's
But that's
amazing.
the type of experience that we're trying to provide with kids. We're trying to, bring these incredibly valuable books, the ones that actually are worth reading because they have stood the test of time. We're trying to give them space to wrestle with these profound ideas through the vehicle of this incredible, incredibly beautiful story. So, I mean, whether or not, it's better to be a banker, IT administrator, college professor, I don't know how much that matters. I feel like the important thing is that like you've got this desire to try to improve the lives of children who are actually going to come after you, treating them as being made in God's image. These things are profound.
I think that's right, because it's not I mean, though I will say, if the if a if someone who wants to go into teaching does genuinely love kids and has that background knowledge in something,
Yeah,
you
they
can
still have to
learn every I
work at
know you
classroom
can but you
management.
can learn almost everything else on the job. It has been very rare. I know a couple of exceptions, but it's very rare for people to really pick up that content knowledge on the job.
Yeah, because that takes time. That doesn't happen over,
Does.
you go to college for 4 years. There's a reason for that. It takes time for these ideas to sink into the head.
Like one other thing I thought of as you were describing that, Winston, is that I would say the oh, now I'm blanking on that thought. Nope, it's gone. It might come back.
You
We'll
do have
see.
procedures that make this easier. The school has a disciplinary procedure that makes it easier to
Oh,
handle
remember the
situations.
thought.
You always have like maybe three rules, no more, no less, that you can easily enforce in the classroom.
If you are an academic who is thinking about jumping down to a K-12 school, I do not advise anybody to try to go straight into school leadership. I know a few friends who wanted to go from finishing PhD to be head of school. I think that's a bad idea. I also, you've got to know that from the school's perspective, hiring, they are probably going to want you to start at a lower grade level than you imagine. Because when I talk to grad students and ask about, have you ever thought about teaching high school? Invariably, they talk about teaching juniors and seniors. And at least in our system, those are the positions that most people earn by like cutting their teeth on middle schoolers. So I would say that too, back to Josh, the humility point. I mean, that it just does require quite a bit of humility to say, oh, I've been learning from the top experts in my field for the last 4 years, and now I'm going to go work with 11-year-olds. And it can be absolutely delightful and beautiful, but you'll wrestle with the intellectual difference for sure.
I think that's where the patience comes in, because a lot of time, sometimes a PhD student comes in and they have the same expectations for their seventh graders that their college professors had with them. And that's just not like reasonable. You've got to, these are students made in God's image, capable of profound, insights, discussions in the classroom and things like that. But it takes an awful lot of time. So you've got to be patient with the students as well as with yourself.
So I want to move on now to a subject near and dear to Ciceronian's heart, a Ciceronian Society's heart, and that is the subject of place. It's not something in these conversations about classical education, what it is, what it looks like, where it's going, et cetera. I don't hear this come up very often, the concept of place, how it relates to locality, how it relates to the local community as much. In fact, in some cases, right, I don't see this with you guys, but in other cases where, well, classical education must be succeeding because we're sending our students off somewhere, right? Look at all these people we educated to leave our community, right? And there's something about that that seems, well, maybe that's something off, right? Is there a place within classical education for this concept of place, for this discussion of place, understanding that you're not simply that part of your education is where you are and where you'll end up geographically, physically. Is there any of that in the conversation?
Yeah, I mean, there's a number, like Thales Academy prides itself on being a community school. So a lot of the campuses that we have, they're serving the needs of a particular group of students in a small town in North Carolina, like Holly Springs or Clayton and so on. We also, like as director of curriculum, I try to build in a lot of meaningful lesson plans and touch points so that students can like investigate like their family background, like interviewing grandparents and uncles for like those sorts of unique stories that we don't always get these days, like, how our families came to America, like, what was it like, growing up in the, during the Great Depression and things like that, knowing more things about like their family history and their family legends that perhaps is lost. And then our founder, Bob, even though he's from Pennsylvania initially, he loves the state of North Carolina and tries to build in as many like uniquely North Carolina facts as possible, just in the layout and the aesthetics of each Thales Academy campus. He's noticed that the architecture kind of supports this love of place, the state in which we grew up in. So every campus has a series of murals and they all have the Wright brothers. sure, they're from Ohio originally, but God saw fit that they would make their great advancement, their great contribution to world history here in the great state of North Carolina. Kitty Hawk, North Carolina, that's where the sand dunes were soft enough to just in case they crash landed. The winds were strong enough to carry their Wright glider. And it was just amazing. But every Thales Academy campus has a mural basically detailing the story of the Wright brothers. And Bob's like hoping that if the kids know this story that, took place in their state, that it's going to inspire them to have the same sort of love, the same sort of like dynamic problem solving that the Wright brothers themselves had. He'll also bring up a lot of anecdotes about Ralph Kittner. I hope I'm getting that name right, but he's the founder of Food Lion. He's from Western North Carolina. Bob talks about him as being like a master of algebra and calculation. Ken Iverson and Nucor Steel, other anecdotes like that, people that saw unique opportunities in the market and seized them. So for Bob, it's really about like linking, great stories in North Carolina, putting them in front of the students in hopes that it will inspire them in the same way to go out and attempt to do great things. I think that's a very Tocquevillian sort of insight into heritage and place, that if you know more things about like your family background, you're going to attempt to do more noble things in hopes of living up to the example of your ancestors. I think that's what we're like, that's how we fulfill that idea of place. So what do you think, Josh?
Yeah, I'd probably take a different tactic on that. I mean, I don't disagree with any of that. I think we do that. But when I think about that question, it seems to me that there's something inevitably linked to place about any private school necessarily, because A state school can appeal to either state money or federal money, but a private school has to articulate a mission that enough people in that area resonate with. And we for Thales Academy, it's a little, I think it's a little bit different in that we don't do fundraising, we don't have donors that we're beholden to. But all of our academies are located in a particular place. We have everybody, all the everyone who studies at a given Thales Academy tends to be within a 20 to 30 mile radius. And as I've gotten kind of older in teaching, and I'm thinking of a, I have a former student who was just commissioned as a second lieutenant in the Navy, and his parents threw a farewell party. And I was astounded. I didn't know any of this when I was teaching him, but there was a network of friends who all lived in the same neighborhood, who had all gone to the same school, K-12. And even as they're now kind of scattering, like there is still a tie towards Wake Forest as home. And their schooling was part of that. And the other thing that came to mind, and I think this is really a tension for higher ed, more so than the pre-K through 12 level. But there is something that has always been the case where people leave home to go to an institution of higher learning. I'm currently working on a presentation for the Association of Classical Christian Schools Conference in a couple weeks. With Hugh of St. Victor. And he has this line that, in part because of some of the things I've learned from Ciceronian Society, really just struck me as odd. But he talks about how the one who is truly learned in the liberal arts will learn to be a bit more, a lot more cosmopolitan. And Hugh of St. Victor himself was from somewhere in what today is Germany. He, at age 8, his uncle took him to the monastery, the Abbey of St. Victor, where they got some relics, and then he stayed there for the rest of his life. And but he always thought of his hometown. I think it was Brandenburg is where he's from. He that was always home, but he had his learning always kind of pushed him to see himself as part of God's universal church, part of this abbey that he swore vows at as his earthly home, his brothers as his family, and really away from his original place. And I think there's probably something to that that's really an ongoing tension for higher education. I mean, it's certainly one that we struggle with at Thales College, because the assumption is, of course, that, oh, Thales College, Thales Academy students will just want to keep going to Thales College. That's for most students, that's not been what we found. What we found is that they finish their time at Thales Academy and they see that as preparatory for going somewhere else. And then hopefully, I hope they come back after that, but that certainly has been the reality that we experience. So I think that tension with place is kind of all over the general question of college.
Well, I think it's all over the place with the general question of education. I mean, I think there is this need. I mean, because I recognize attention as well in myself. Like I think to myself, like there are just certain things I had to leave home to just to learn about, to discover in many ways, I think. And I did not come back. I came back to my home state. I didn't come back to my hometown. And I'm not sure I could have in many ways. And for some people, of course, it's, you know, for me, it wasn't, had no, there was no drama that kept me away. But it was just, it just, the ability to find work, right? I mean, is also part of this. And especially in the economy for individuals of our generation, the gig economy, the transience that we have to face is so. It's so pronounced for many of us. I mean, I have fought to stay here in Holland, Michigan, where I'm at, because and it has not necessarily always been easy. I gotten really lucky in the last year to be able to do it. But a lot of your, you know, our graduates, they want to be rooted into a place, whether they're in college or the academy, and it's tough in this day and age. If you want to pay the bills, you want to have the kind of friends and community you want to have the church that you're looking for, right? The kind of church you can really connect with, and so. Yeah, I respect that tension, and I see it in higher ed in particular. It's one of the things that that a lot of these colleges are doing is they have rules about how far away you can live from campus. Now, some do this, some don't. But I remember a couple of the places I interviewed at, like you had to live within a certain distance of the because so many faculty lived, I mean, in some cases another state, in some cases, you know, 3 or 4 counties away. And so they just came to the campus. They had no connection to the town, and then they just left. And it was a really striking model of placelessness, in that respect. But let me go on to the next question.
Well, can I tell
Yeah,
one
go
more
ahead.
story before we move on? This really hit me when I was looking at PhD studies, because I was trying to figure out where to go. And I'd been teaching at Thales Academy for 5 or 6 years at that point. My wife and I had been in the same church. We had just bought our first house. And I was really looking at the University of Dallas or Faulkner University's online PhD program. And Faulkner was the right fit. I'm really glad I went there. But the question of place became really significant because I was thinking about, do I want to uproot my wife and myself from six, at this, that point, 5 years of established relationships, the prospect of building equity, the having like a real employee's health insurance instead of graduate health insurance, like all, but then also relationships at our church. Like all of that, the mainstream model of graduate studies says go to the most prestigious place you can get into, wherever that is, and it will be worth it. And I have not found, I've found that actually staying in this area and continuing to work for the same company while kind of taking an alternative route to the PhD was actually really helpful because it let me stay in the same place instead of moving around. I've now got other friends who've taken other routes, and they have been all over. They're just so unrooted after 6 years of graduate study, and then a 2 years of a postdoc, and then 3 years of bouncing around to 1 year fellowships, and then hoping to kind of actually like build a home somewhere. And so, one last plug for this is, I think, another huge benefit of teaching, because teaching does tie you to a place, it ties you to a community of families, and it ties you to, in a healthy school, a team of great friends.
And all those people can help you like form your identity. Whereas if you go off to like the best, most prestigious school, you're kind of a mercenary. You might just be like set adrift on a wild and raging sea.
Now, to shift gears here a little bit, we're at a weird, as I sense this, we're at a weird moment in kind of the history of American education at every level, right? Higher ed, from pre-K to the PhD, things are changing. They need to change. I mean, it's one of those situations where I'm a conservative, so if I say if it ain't broke, don't fix it. Well, it's broke. Something needs to be done. I'm encouraged by what y'all are doing. But looking ahead in classical education, if you look around the corner what do you think is coming next? The good and the bad. I think there's a little bit of both perhaps around the corner. What do you looking ahead next 5, 10 years, especially for classical education in the United States, what are you preparing yourself for? What are you thinking ahead to?
Certainly more students, because as each classical school gets off the ground and produces more graduates, like people recognize that those graduates are more articulate, they're more respectful and responsible and professional. They carry with them this way, a wealth of intellectual knowledge as far as, the books, the philosophy, history, literature, the Western canon, and they want more of it. Most of the parents that we've encountered at Thales recognize that something very valuable was taken from them, that they, went through a program that didn't emphasize Latin, that didn't put the very best books in front of them and help them wrestle with the ideas and the language they're in so they could better understand it. So I think as time goes on, we're going to have more students, particularly since, since COVID, so many parents are seeing what is actually being offered in the local public schools and they don't like it. And so more and more states, North Carolina is one of them. Virginia looks like it's joining that fray. Texas has already enacted, radical state choice policies, but really opening the floodgates of public monies, public assistance, like these opportunity scholarships, so that more students can go to a school of their choice. And I think more and more students are going to choose this sort of school that emphasizes truth, beauty, and goodness, and this incredible intellectual inheritance that comes towards them. I like thinking about in classical education, we're taking a brand of education that once was reserved for the elites of old and new England, you know, the type of education offered at like Phillips Exeter or at Eton and some of these other places. And we're democratizing it in the very best sense of the word, making it accessible for as many students as possible that can come through a Thales Academy or a like-minded classical school, really democratizing, making accessible this brand of education that molded the minds of the founding fathers, Galileo, Isaac Newton, and the like, making it accessible for more kids who are just ordinary to go through and get the riches of a classical education.
So I would add to that the, I think I'm with Winston on thinking there's gonna be more students looking for this, and more states are creating channels where that can be done more easily. There's already a proliferation of models. You've certainly got the homeschool classical world, you've got the charter world, you've got the private classical world. You've now got a growing number of hybrid model, university model, 2 or 3 days mm-hmm. in classroom with parents handling a lot of just overseeing work at home kind of approaches. So I think those are all going to continue. The big fault line I think I see on the horizon, and this is some of this came up 2 summers ago and it sort of simmered down, but it was enough that made me think this is coming. Is the question of which ideologies do not fit within classical education? The big questions of feminism or racial representation in text list, I think, is the place where this kind of shows up most readily. And we've had some discussions here at the Academy about that over the years. I think it's going to be the big question of like if classical education grows to the point where it's actually a viable national alternative to public education, that's going to go one of two directions. Either there's going to be a clear articulation of these things are in the tent. It's a big tent, but it's the kind of tent with those walls on the edge, or it's a massive open tent and all the ideological faults of public education can just sneak right on in.
Yeah.
And I don't think it's hard to articulate what those faults of public ed are. The hard thing is going to be saying, yeah, you can say you're classical, but you're not. So, mm-hmm. and even then the integration of technology is another place where that's probably going to happen. Whether or not artificial intelligence can be a component that advances classical ed is a live question. We got teachers who will answer all across the spectrum of that one. I'm thinking of my buddy Adam Mangana at Optima Classical. Mm-hmm. They're the virtual reality classical school. Like, can you deliver a classical education through a VR headset? Like, these questions right now are still quasi-hypothetical, but if the bigger classical ed grows, the more important those questions are going to be to answer. The last thing I'll say to that is that, like, I hope we see a lot more of these, but at Thales College, we believe that students who actually buy into their classical education in K-12, and let's just to be clear, like, not every student in a classical school, like, agrees with the kind of education he or she is receiving. But for those students that do, that think, actually, this is great, I want more of this, we need more colleges that are recovering kind of the next step that can take the level of academic rigor and training and academic writing, but still also affirm that Shakespeare was real. and take that places like New St. Andrews, New College Franklin, and what we're doing at Thales College are in that mode. And that's really where I see a lot of hope on the higher ed horizon. We're just like, there ought to be. There's another one here in North Carolina. New Aberdeen College just started. That is just starting this fall. These are all places that are looking at a coming wave of closures in old colleges and thinking, well, actually, it may be a good thing that those old colleges are closing if they were actually bad colleges.
Yeah.
That's not to say that people don't love them, but if their finances are shaky and their ideas are not good, then yeah, it's probably a good thing civilizationally that they close. Well, that means we need a whole bunch of new institutions that are actually recovering the good, the true, and the beautiful in a collegiate setting. And that's why I'm really excited to be part of where I'm at. So that's my answer to your question, Josh.
Mm-hmm. Really, a lot of interesting conversations. Just want to encourage our listeners, if you're that future of education is a big topic for us at Ciceronian, because many of us are disaffected by the systems that we grew up in or that are we are still a part of. So, I mean, that's not true of everybody. I mean, like Josh just said, he's really happy where he's at. That's not always the story, especially among those of us in higher ed. We weren't always fortunate to have that experience. But trying to think of opportunities for our entrepreneurship in education is just so valuable. And whether, you know, this question of technology, I mean, my knee-jerk reaction is keep AI as far away from it as you possibly can. But is that feasible forever, right? I mean, your student, you know, the students are going to graduate into a world where AI is there. How are they going to handle it, right? And this question of like what does and does not fit. I mean, I think there's some pretty, it's pretty obvious answers in terms of what doesn't fit, right? I mean, in terms of, you know, critical theory as a tradition, as an intellectual tradition, is by definition hostile to tradition. How can anything hostile to tradition fit within the paradigm of classical? I mean, any kind of paradigm of education that values and is grateful for an inheritance cannot accept critical theory as something to work with. However, it's also important to know what critical theory is, right? So how do we deal with that? It's like I think of it, like if I'm teaching a classical education, I don't think Marx is classical, but I think an educated person needs to have read Marx and know who Marx was, right? This is one of my favorite. I mean, people like Marx, Rousseau, and Machiavelli. I mean, I can get really upset about what they say, but they're so much fun to teach too. I could teach on Marx and Rousseau forever.
Yeah, to that point, Josh, I mean, I think it goes back to what we were saying earlier about the attitude that the teacher brings to it.
Yeah.
I've taught Marx, now only the Communist Manifesto. I don't go any deeper into Marx than the Manifesto, mm-hmm. but
yeah.
I've taught the Manifesto probably to every group of high school students that I had in 11th and 12th grade. And we read him again in freshman Western Civ 2 at the college this last year. And in each case, what I thought was fascinating is that when students actually read Marx, they see through him so quickly.
Yeah.
Like, I think the same thing happens. Like if students were to actually read Simone de Beauvoir and actually like in a yeah. place where she's not presented as the goddess who has descended from on high with the new revelation, but actually like, does this describe the feminine experience? So I think part of that too is that is wrestling with the like what exactly classical education doesn't. I don't think we have to run away from these things, but it does. It means we actually have to know what is true and approach falsehoods accordingly. It's not that we avoid them, but that part of our job in leading a good Socratic seminar is not to ever make truth claims. Socrates made truth claims all the time. His goal was to get his audience to see those truths. Mm-hmm. And that's what I think we bring in the classical setting is like, no, we're not just going to avoid, we can't put our head in the sand and say, oh yeah, Freud never existed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What we do need to do is actually like, if you actually read Freud, he's honest. I don't find Freud that persuasive or that interesting. Like I don't find him nearly as complex as his disciples think he is. And so I think that's something worth doing at the right age. Cause that's the other piece.
Oh, like, especially with Freud.
Yeah. There are topics that I think are highly appropriate to the collegiate setting that I would never introduce in middle school.
Right.
And there's a kind of in-between land in high school that you got to be real careful what you introduce and when.
Yeah.
I think a lot of too is the starting points that you engage these texts. So in like reading Marx, you know, he rejects God and everything else falls under that. Like the power dynamics, like the struggle, the class struggles between master and slave, between the bourgeoisie and the proletariat, the lords and the serfs. I mean, everything kind of flows out from, and honestly, the world apart from Christ seems very much like that world of unending class struggles and brutal naked power dynamics. I mentioned that we read Machiavelli in that ninth grade research and writing book, and I try to set that up very, very carefully, oftentimes juxtaposing it with Boethius and the Consolation of Philosophy. Mm-hmm. I think this is just a profound like illustration to point out with students, but Boethius and Machiavelli had eerily similar stories prior to getting into prison. Right. They were betrayed by people that they had trusted. They were thrown into prison, tortured. Machiavelli brags about being hoisted up on the rack 13 times, but he's never broken. Boethius, while he's in prison, you know, remains committed to the path of wisdom and virtue. The Consolation of Philosophy is all just that, that the good life is worth pursuing for its own sake and not for the sake of the wealth, the esteem, the praises that you may get from being in high positions of power and influence. Machiavelli, coming out of prison, though, is just, you know, just bent on survival. And that's really the only thing that matters. The good life does not matter. What really matters is playing the game of Renaissance politics to such an extent that you're never betrayed again. You're never in a position of weakness again, that suffering and injustice would ever befall you. Those are the things I think are really good to bring out with students. Like, these are real people that grappled with circumstances very much like the ones that you're going with. Like, yeah, they're probably not going to get arrested by Theodoric and thrown into prison, but they're going to get betrayed by a friend. They're going to get like people sharing secrets that they thought were shared in confidence or whatever it is, right? These are things that are common for the human experience. And you've got to like steal kids' hearts so that they can make the right choice when such hardship befalls them. It's like that C.S. Lewis quote, like, the kids know that dragons exist. They need to know that dragons can be killed. So you've got to give them the stories of chivalry and noble character. And at times, like the scoundrels and the villains who did so much to like undermine the tradition of goodness and truth that we're trying to pass on to these students.
Yeah. I want to close with this last question on, well, let me take a step back. You know, one of the things that is striking me here is I'm thinking about how over the years, you know, Ciceronian society as an organization, there's one of my challenges is to tell our story. Who are we? What are we doing? And what is it about? And as you guys know, and this is true with any college or any program of press, whatever, you develop a reputation that you just develop whether you like it or not. And you develop and then you try and write that narrative and that story. Well, one of the things that's happened with the Ciceronian society, and I don't mind this, is we are often immediately associated with classical education. Interestingly. I mean, I have encountered this on multiple instances. Now, that's not a problem to me. I view us more as a parachurch and para-university organization. That's kind of we inhabit this weird space parallel to those two cultural institutions. But over time, we've inhabited this world where we intersect with classical education way more than I thought we ever would, and certainly more than we intended to. Not that we ever would have kept you out, right? I mean, it's certainly there's so much sympathy between the groups. I'm just wondering if this gets to part of the not just the future of classical ed, but the future for your students, because there's something to be said about the need for people like the two of you and your fellow teachers and the families that are working with these kids. That world of intellectual discipleship and intellectual friendship is missing. And I'm just wondering if, because I don't even know how you guys found Ciceronian, actually, or in how the word about us has gotten out. But I'm just wondering, what does something like our group offer you that has attracted so many classical educators to our conference in particular? Because again, we didn't go looking for this, and we're not upset that y'all found us. At all. I think it's been such we love you guys. And so like, what, how did that happen? And why do you think that's a thing at all?
So I'll start this one, since I think I've been connected with Ciceronian longer than Winston has. So this weirdly starts with, some of my dissatisfaction in seminary. So I did my Master's of Divinity at Southeastern Baptist Theological Seminary. And my dissatisfaction is really no fault of Southeastern's. It was really literally just my own, because I came out of Hillsdale College for undergrad, and I got out of Hillsdale, and my wife and I just got married. We're settling into graduate study, and I just did not find the intellectual community that I was looking for at seminary. I had a few friends. Winston was one of those. Noah Kelly was another, who were the exception to what I'm about to say.
We have a lot of stories. So Josh was actually my next door neighbor, but we met at the church that we attended. Yeah. So like, I think we just struck up a conversation. It's like, yeah, you know, I'm living in, you know, these townhouses at Southeastern. And, you know, it's like, you know, it's like four of us bunking together. It's real tight. It's like, yeah, like I'm living at those same townhouses. Oh, you too? Where? And like, we told each other, like, we were apparently next door neighbors.
Yeah, 15 and 16.
That's just like how crazy busy both of us were at the time.
But Most of my classes were oriented towards a professor delivers the lecture, do a little bit of reading, write a paper, and be done. There was no kind of ongoing like press some ideas as far as they can go, or no real interest in like going beyond the stated questions of the class necessarily in a lot of the coursework I did there. And I started getting into listening to podcasts for, and that really became a place where I kind of kept up some of the humanistic conversations that I'd encountered in college. And I spent probably 7 or 8 years as a devoted listener to the Christian Humanist Radio Network. And they were one of the first such discussion-based podcasts formed out of a group of guys that all went to grad school, University of Georgia together. And as a spin-off show, Coyle Neal, who I think you know, Josh, at he launched his own show called The City of Man. And I don't know what year this was, but he broadcasted one episode from the Ciceronian Society. It was when Michael Watson, I don't know if his co-author was there, but he was
He
presenting
wasn't.
about, okay.
C.S. Lewis.
So
Yeah,
Michael
it was
did
back
a,
in 2018, actually, at Hope College.
yep. And he presented on his recent book, C.S. Lewis and Natural Law, and I just loved it. And the phrase Ciceronian Society was stuck in my head ever since. Well, if you jump forward to whichever year, I think it was 2022, you guys were at Belmont Abbey College. That sound right?
2023.
2023, Belmont Abbey College. I was already planning to go, and I think I had registered to go, and then somehow you and I were emailing back and forth, and I think I volunteered to be a discussant or something for Jason Jewell's Tolkien panel. But
Okay.
then you had somebody drop out of a classical ed panel, and so I drove. I suddenly was like, oh, I can now pitch this as a PD opportunity
There you
because I'm
go.
going for classical ed. So suddenly all my expenses were covered, and I came out as the first time I'd actually been at Ciceronian Society. And I just loved the people that I met there. I met great. I just it was the and I it was the first academic conference I'd gone to where the papers weren't boring and people didn't take themselves too seriously. I was like, it was perfectly okay to read a mediocre paper and then just be hammered by questions from senior academics, and then everyone was friends at the end of it. It was great. And so I left there thinking like, this is awesome. And then the one in Dallas the next year was the same. Same experience this last year. And so again, Dallas, I pitched you a panel on classical education and the Inklings, and you were amazing and gave us a plenary. I didn't know how good that was, and that was amazing. And then this year we did another panel on Winston wanted to do a sponsorship, and we did a panel on oh, I'm trying to remember what our actual panel was
I'm
on. We
already
had
forgetting.
limits in the
That's
human
right.
condition. Limits in the human condition, classical education. So I keep coming back because of the people that are there and the conversations that happen and the ideas. I always learn stuff going to Ciceronian.
No. That's great. Yeah, I think too, there is something to be said about, so the content knowledge you spoke of, that we need to be good educators. I have found that you can't read everything, right? It's just that that's a truism. But collectively, y'all can read a lot, right? And so in the sense that there's so much to be said about you can learn more of what you need to know in community. And I think there's something to that that really helps classical education in many ways. So anyways, so let's conclude with this. Give our listeners something. If they want to learn more about Thales Academy, Thales Press, and Thales College, where do they go? What do they do?
Well, there are three distinct institutions there, each of which are serving like a different segment of the student population, the market, whatever it may be. For parents who are interested in the unique brand of classical education that we have at Thales Academy, you can check us out at our website at www.thalesacademy.org. The website has a lot of articles and our unique brand of classical education, videos that we've compiled over the years that really emphasizes some of our unique teaching aspects. Kindergarten through fifth grade, we utilize a method of instruction called DI, direct instruction, that makes it possible to teach phonics and literacy and math fluency with incredible, you know, grace and poise and efficiency to relatively large classes of students, you know, 20, 25 kids. It's difficult teaching those students how to read, and DI gives our teachers an incredible degree of control over the classroom. And we have really good results coming out of those programs. You know, students that have come in not reading on grade level at all, you know, not served well by their local public school, coming into a Thales Academy, and by God's grace, able to make up a lot of the lost ground, you know, as far as learning to read and those incredibly valuable skills. With the press, www.thalespress.org. And there we have links to a series of articles that extol our unique brand of classical education, links to our books, many of which are available for free as far as PDFs and EPUBs. And then you can buy physical published copies on Amazon to your heart's content. We also have YouTube, a YouTube channel that has like a lot of the conferences that we put on. Some of those are for staff and faculty. So there might be more practical, like how to teaching moments. But we also have a big conference that we have in the spring called the Liberty and Literacy Forum. That's really about bridging that gap between liberty on the one hand and the habits of self-government and individual rights and freedoms and personal responsibilities and literacy. You know, how education plays in developing, you know, leading citizens for the United States today. Like, how are we going to keep our republic? Well, that conference is about answering how a school should be structured in such a way to keep our republic. I'll let Josh handle Thales College, though, because this is his, you know, him and the team over at Thales College. This is their wheelhouse.
It is. Thank you, Winston. So for everything Thales College related, you can check out thalescollege.org. You'll find there our program of study. And again, we do a single Bachelor of Arts degree in Entrepreneurial Business and Liberal Arts. But you can see our course descriptions and everything there. You can, if you go to the Academics tab on thalescollege.org, you'll also see the Certificate in Classical Education Philosophy. I don't know when this episode will drop on the Sower feeds, but we should have that website updated after July 1st, 2025, with the next set of dates that we're offering. We offer all 8 courses in the certificate class 3 times a year. Those are lined up with the second, third, and fourth quarters of each academic year, so as to allow working teachers to get their school year started and then jump into kind of a little bit more of extra stuff for professional development. Now, I've been speaking this whole podcast as if the certificate program is only for teachers. I do want to also mention that this really is for anybody who is out of high school that wants to continue to grow in these ways with reading these different sets of books. I've had students who are still in college that want to do this. I have homeschool parents who do not have college degrees that thrive in this setting. And I've got professors at other colleges who are like, oh, that looks interesting. I'll take that. You can come join a great community of people in a really lively setting. Last thing I'll mention is not on our website yet, but it should be shortly. Thales College hosts the Southeastern Consortium of Classical Educators Conference each August. So this year, this is our second annual one. It'll be August 1st and 2nd. We've got a phenomenal lineup of keynote speakers that I'll name drop briefly. That's Matthew Crawford, Marilyn Simon, Scott Postman, and Dr. James Hankins will all be speaking on different variations of humanism and why we need to really fight to recover a right understanding of humanism and why classical education is actually the best poised place in America today to do that. So August 1st and 2nd, would love for you to come join us. But again, for everything Thales College, it's all on the website, thalescollege.org.
Fantastic. Winston and Josh, thank you so much. Always a pleasure.
Thanks, Josh.
Thank you, Josh.
You've been listening to The Sower, a production of the Ciceronian Society. If you've enjoyed this conversation, we hope you'll consider signing up for our newsletter and joining us for a future event. If you haven't heard yet, we'll be having our 2026 conference at Creighton University in Omaha, Nebraska, March 12th through the 14th, 2026. Sponsorship opportunities are still available. Be sure to rate and review this podcast, share it with your friends, and check out our website at ciceroniansociety.org. Now, may the grace of our Lord Jesus Christ and the love of God and the fellowship of the Holy Spirit be with us all evermore. Thank you for listening.